Pat Cadigan was one of the first female writers in the early days of cyberpunk fiction. She moved from an early writing job for Hallmark Cards to creating award-winning short stories and novels. Her cyberpunk novels and short stories led to her being called the Queen of Cyberpunk. Pat joins the Plutopia podcast this time as we discuss cyberpunk and science fiction.
So I didn't really know very much about what was going on. I knew that I'd read Bill Gibson's fiction and I loved it, you know. And it was just the type of thing that piqued my interest and, you know, made me think good thoughts. You know, creative thoughts. And it's just, I forget whether it was Bruce Sterling or John Shirley who said that, I think John said that this was a tribal thing more than anything, in that we were people who, we were baby boomers who, you know, we'd grown up at more or less the same time we came of age. We were the first generation with mass media and with travel that could be accomplished within a scarily short amount of time.
Hey, welcome everybody to yet another episode of the Plutopia podcast. I'm here with my co-host and partner Scoop Sweeney and our other co-host Wendy Grossman. And our guest today is Pat Cadigan. Pat is a renowned science fiction and, don't laugh, and cyberpunk author. She's known for works like Sinners and Mind Players. In 2023, she released a novelization of the classic Japanese Ultraman TV series. And in July, she's going to have yet another novelization. Is that July?
I think
Ultra so. 7?
I think it's scheduled for July. Ultra 7.
Yeah. So Ultra 7 will be out in July. And I think on my end, what I really would like to talk about today is cyberpunk, because I think we're there.
Oh,
I think that it was prophetic.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Although, you know, there's an awful lot that you can tell about a culture when you read the future in the entrails of its technology, so to speak. If that made sense to anybody.
No, that makes sense. How did you actually get drawn into the cyberpunk subgenre as a science fiction author?
I just wrote about what I was interested in, and what I was interested in was the impact of technology on human life, day-to-day life, emotional life, psychologically, physically, all that. And while the big centers for cyberpunk writing were, you know, in Austin, Texas, and British Columbia, and wherever else anyone was living, I wasn't really in touch with anybody. And so I just kept writing the stuff that I was interested in. And eventually, Bruce Sterling made contact with me. But I didn't really know very much about what was going on. I knew that I'd read Bill Gibson's fiction and I loved it, you know. And it was just the type of thing that piqued my interest and, you know, made me think good thoughts, you know, creative thoughts. And it's just, I forget whether it was Bruce Sterling or John Shirley who said that, I think John said that this was a tribal thing more than anything, in that, we were people who, we were baby boomers who, you know, we'd grown up at more or less the same time we came of age. We were the first generation with mass media and with travel that could be accomplished within a scarily short amount of time. And in that, that was, you know, that was why, one of the reasons why Vietnam veterans were having such a hard time. They'd be in this, you know, in this horror, this war, and then they'd be put on a plane, and within 18 hours they were, you know, they were back in civilization, and the, you know, the shock of it, you know, that was one of the things that certainly didn't help. So we were future shocked and location shocked and culture shocked and just all kinds of things shocked. And I think this was what cyberpunk was really handling, was the shocking impact of things on people.
Were there any other women?
Back in the mid 80s, no.
And
I would, you know, it's like I checked, I looked.
And I'm was, sure.
And there really weren't any, at that time, there really weren't any other women writing what I was writing. And I called it a statistical anomaly. Today, you can find a lot of women writing, you know, very hard science and cyberpunk. You know, it's not like it was. It's almost like it was a different planet.
Yeah, of course, the question is always, were there women writing and they just didn't get published?
Well, maybe, but there's, you know, it's like there's no way I can know that.
No, indeed.
But I
knew some women who were writing science fiction back then, but in fact, they weren't getting published and they weren't writing cyberpunk fiction either. The only person that came to mind for me was Pat Murphy. Do you remember her?
Oh, yeah. Pat Murphy.
Was she writing science fiction, cyberpunk science fiction?
Not to the same extent that I was, you know, although she was writing very, you know, very solid, respectable stuff. And I think in one of his essays, Bruce did mention her. And but then, you know, he stopped. And I think it was, I don't know what it was. But, you know, if I had to do it over again, I think I would have insisted that I would have kept mentioning her name as another woman, cyberpunk. Except that, you know, it's like I may have been opening both of us up to, you know, the usual abuse.
More of my contact with science fiction was really in the 1970s, but I remember meeting Joanna Russ.
Yes, I had the privilege of meeting Joanna Russ once, and it was not long before she died, but it was so good to meet her. She grabbed me and hugged me.
I'm looking at the contents of Mirror Shades. I always think of Mirror Shades as being sort of like a seminal anthology, and edited by Bruce Sterling.
Mm-hmm.
And you are the only woman listed there.
Yep.
And otherwise, it's kind of the usual suspects. Shirley is there, and William Gibson, and Tom Maddox, the late Tom Maddox, is there, and Rudy Rucker. That was kind of a great anthology, but there was a lot of really great stuff going on then. The thing that really, so it was a literary subgenre of science fiction at the time. And I remember being on a panel at the National, or not being, being present at a panel in the National Science Fiction Convention where Bruce and John Shirley were on a panel with Greg Bear, and I can't remember who else was there.
Rudy Rucker.
But it turned into...
Rudy Rucker.
Rucker was on that, yeah.
Luke Shiner.
Do you remember that turned into a kind of a fight, and John Shirley walked off the panel?
Yeah, well, I didn't blame him. The problem was that Lou was supposed to be the moderator. And when he got there, this guy that none of us had ever heard of or knew said, "I'm the moderator." And Lou, unfortunately, did not oppose him. Lou just said, "Okay, you're the moderator." And But the guy didn't know anything about cyberpunk, so he just blathered on about, you know, whatever he wanted to blather on about. And it wasn't, it turned out to be really, you know, kind of a waste of time. But Rudy and I had both, you know, when we spoke afterwards, we had both come from a long way away and we hadn't come to walk out. So we refused to walk out. I remember Bruce and Lou walked out as well, but we got Lou to come back.
Yeah, I remember very well that Lou looked very conflicted as he was walking out, and he was actually standing kind of near me, and it was like he would move a little bit one way and a little bit the other, and he finally walked back up to the front. But the person that sort of hijacked the panel was Greg Bear. I remember that pretty distinctly. And the deal was that, as you say, he wasn't really an author of cyberpunk fiction. So he really didn't even fit the panel, let alone should he have been moderating it.
I think met him at one of those conferences with people doing life extension and things.
Well, Greg actually did write some cyberpunk worthy stuff. The story that he won the Nebula for, Petra. And I don't remember if that's the one that's included in Mirror Shades or not. But if Bruce gave you the, you know, if Bruce knighted you and made you a cyberpunk, you were a cyberpunk. And actually, Greg had hijacked the panel basically because the know-nothing moderator was doing a worse job. So Greg just started talking. And and of course that
Oh, so he wasn't the moderator. He was just another member of the panel.
Greg wasn't the moderator. I was sitting between him and Rudy Rucker. And Greg started, you know, actually talking about things of substance that the moderator had just sort of mentioned off the cuff, or, you know, just to have something to talk about on the panel. Greg's a very intelligent guy, but he ended up kind of monopolizing the conversation. And go ahead.
Find the name of the guy. The thing that I found that listed everybody who was on the panel actually says that it was a fan that was actually moderating the panel, not another author. And this person couldn't remember his name either. So I guess it doesn't really matter. The thing that strikes me is that, so this is like the 1980s. I think that convention was 1985, as I recall.
Yeah.
And since then, cyberpunk has gone through this evolution from being kind of an underground science fiction subgenre kind of thing to more of a mainstream cultural force, really. I mean, cyberpunk is it's actually kind of the reality that we're living in now.
Well, I wish.
And I wish
I could remember when I heard this, but it was in like the very late 70s or the very early 80s. My then husband and I were getting ready for work in the morning. We had the radio on and they played Gary Newman's Cars. It was the first time I'd heard it and I was just blown away. And the song ended and the DJ came back and he said, "There's a little cyberpunk for you in the morning." And then he just went on talking. So I don't know where the word actually came from, but I've not forgotten him saying, "There's a little cyberpunk for you in the morning." And I thought, cyberpunk, that's pretty good.
Yeah, early sci-fi always had computers of some sort in them, but they're usually something like a big mainframe. But when personal computers came along, that's when I remember you know, cyberpunk becoming really interesting and, you know, it's totally different from, I'd been reading all sorts of science fiction since I was a little kid, but this was something totally new, and it seemed to kind of map into the whole change of culture. But, you know, we had personal computers, we had new kinds of music, and a lot of drug use seemed to also get involved.
Well, also with cyberpunk, someone would come up with a, you know, an ingenious piece of software or hardware or both, but it didn't necessarily work as a panacea. Things went wrong. Things would go wrong with the machinery. Things would go wrong with the people who were using it. And it was actually a bit truer to, you know, what's eventually happening. And, you know, it's like, I always wrote from the vantage point of the end user. I'm the one who would get the malfunctioning monitor, you know, or the software disk with a scratch in it, or whatever.
That reminds me of Robert Sheckley.
Yes,
he was always writing about defective technology.
Yeah,
yeah. The other thing, when the COVID pandemic began. I think it was Charlie Strauss talking on whatever social medium we were all using at the time, saying that you know, the thing that all the science fiction novels of doom and disaster got wrong was they assumed competent governance.
Yeah. That's God. That's so true, and getting truer by the minute.
It's cyberpunk fixed that for sure. Yeah. I just realized that one of the early influences on what became cyberpunk would have probably been Michael Moorcock. Mm-hmm. And he lives close to Scoop. He lives out in Bastrop.
Wow.
Oddly enough, for a British sci-fi author, he moved to Texas.
Yeah.
If he's still here, I assume he is.
He is still, he's still there. And
so
I'll
just say, I remember, so I was at some point involved in sort of the early internet scene and the Mondo 2000 scene and Boing Boing and all of those things. And I ran into somebody at some point who started talking about cyberpunk, and it was very clear to me that he wasn't talking about cyberpunk as a literary subgenre, but he was talking about it as a movement and referring to himself as a cyberpunk, you know, people talking about themselves as being cyberpunks. And I think that was sort of an interesting thing. It's like a lot of what was happening with the internet at that time was influenced quite a bit by cyberpunk fiction.
Well, also, it really was kind of a spirit of the times. I can remember going into Borders Books on Saturday morning to check out what was new. I'd go to the magazine rack, and there'd be, you know, Mondo 2000 and Wired and Boing Boing and a million other zines like that. And I'd look at them, you know, and my heart would lift, and I'd think, the future is wide open, you know, and how nice it would be, you know, if that had turned out to be true. But, I'm working on it as, you know, about as much as I can. But I very much, at first, it was just science fiction to me, but I began to get the sense that, It was a feeling, a lifestyle, a point of view, a way of thinking. And I really liked that. I liked the fact that it had jumped out of a literary category, you know, for you know, writing and stories. And it was as if there was give and take between writing and the world that it was reflecting, I don't know if I'm expressing that very well, but I really liked that. I felt like science fiction was more in touch with reality than it had ever been.
Yeah, and you know, it seems to me that at the time, I mean, at the time, we had people who were sort of thinking of themselves as aligning with that cyberpunk themes, but it seems that the political and corporate reality of that time was almost quaint compared to today. I mean, we really are living with the kinds of things that were so much a part of that fiction, with artificial intelligence emerging and corporate surveillance becoming a much bigger thing, digital resistance, authoritarian leaders, and that sort of thing. It feels like it was pretty prophetic. Did you feel that it was going to be a prophecy that would be fulfilled the time?
I felt like it was building on a lot of already existing things that was producing a plausible plausible vision of the future, and I did feel like we were, you know, it's like, and I wasn't concerned that all the science fiction would predict and be absolutely correct. It was like a laboratory where all experiments were legitimate. Just try this, try that, try this, try that. And, you know, the damnedest things happened. I like to point to the cell phone as the against all odds bit of technology, because when we were writing cyberpunk, the future, Bill Gibson once wrote something that said something like, I imagine people in the future reading Neuromancer and thinking, oh, look at this prescient book that has absolutely no cell phones in it. And for us, the cell phone was anti-intuitive, counterintuitive, because they had learned that cordless phones could, the conversation on cordless phones could be picked up, like, you know, on shortwave radios, including the police. So people, you know, got careful and cagey about, you know, and eventually cordless phones disappeared, but they were replaced by cell phones. And no one really imagined that they'd be replaced by cell phones, because cordless phones were a problem with privacy. But our attitude towards privacy has also changed. In 1985, we'd be talking about something, and if you were talking about something kind of sensitive on the phone, you'd say, maybe let's discuss this in person. I don't want to talk about it on the phone because, you know, someone may be listening. And in 2025, you have, hey, Alexa, wiretap, give me a recipe for pancakes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've given up some of our privacy also as an effect of social media, because as you become more social, you also sort of inherently become less private. You're opening yourself up more to other people. And if you open yourself up to
it does depend what kind of thing you post. If you don't post anything except links to your work, then you're not going to have that, really.
But
I'm thinking of social media being truly social, and when you're really socializing with people, you're talking to your friends about whatever's going on with you, and you know, it's not just a matter of posting links if it's truly social. I mean, I think you get beyond that. And I think a lot of people don't even think about the fact that other people may be paying attention, people they might not want to be paying attention.
Well, the problem is that social socializing by computer, socializing online is so deceptive. You're doing it online in your house, and you're probably alone. So you're sitting there in front of your computer, and it feels like you're just typing into your computer. And people forget, you know, or they don't visualize the gigantic network of people that can see all of their photos, all of their posts about, you know, what terrific things they've done, or, you know, how lousy the day was, or whatever. And I think people would be quite alarmed if someone who's, you know, like very good at profiling showed them how much they reveal about themselves by what they put up, you know, and what they talk about. And
I came out of the skeptical movement, and one of the things there is that the way psychics convince people that they know special things about them is that they remember what they've been told, and
yeah,
they hand it back to them. So I was always kind of aware of that, the, you know, the sort of power of putting together things you've forgotten, you've said.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, psychics call, well, magicians call that cold reading. And it's very much a technique that you can use. It's incredibly simple. I remember talking to a TV researcher one time and, you know, actually almost convincing him I was talking to his dead father. And it only took me about 10 seconds. It was incredible.
Yeah.
I'm realizing that Elon Musk could be a character from a cyberpunk novel. He would be a really good fit for that.
Wouldn't you kill him off in the first chapter?
No comment. But, you know, one of the things that we're hearing now is a concern that because he has access to all the data in all of the government agencies, that he may be copying that data into a large language model, an LLM, to create this sort of surveillance state, overwhelming artificial intelligence that would give him sort of primacy over everybody.
And he's on ketamine.
Paranoid. Yeah, he's on ketamine. That's right.
That's the stuff.
Probably Adderall too.
It's the stuff that killed Matthew Perry, ketamine.
Yeah, and he's on ketamine, which makes stupid shit seem like a really great idea. But
I kind of worry more that in copying the data, he's creating something that he can use to, you know, sort of torture people later. Not torture, but, you know, if he's got control of Social Security payments and stuff, and you know, he can be, you know, judging from the way he's run Twitter, he can be quite capricious in who he decides to punish. So I kind of worry about the ability to, you know, really inflict hurt on people, you know, just in a very fine-grained way if he has copied all the data.
Well, my Social Security is part of the income that we depend on, you know, to live. And I really don't like the idea that it's in his hands. But that's another thing that we didn't think of in, I guess in cyberpunk, you know, the CEOs and the heads of big companies were villains. But people with, you know, techies were usually good guys. And Elon Musk isn't a good guy. You know, he's pretty damn far from being a good guy.
Yeah, early sci-fi or cyberpunk fiction was featuring hackers who are doing great things for the people. And they were more of a romantic, you know, hero kind of thing. And that transformed severely in the current environment online is the hackers that are out there doing things are doing really bad things for really bad people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, originally, who would have thought that Anonymous would morph into QAnon?
Did it, though? I thought it was quite different people.
It may have happened because different people came in, but the basis, I believe, was Anonymous. I could be wrong. Being wrong is one of my superpowers.
I think you are wrong. What I know of Anonymous is that it was a kind of hacker collective that went around making certain kinds of trouble. But QAnon, James Ball wrote a book about the origins of QAnon, and he traces it to 4chan.
That's right.
He used to hang around 4chan as a teenager. He found it entertaining and a laugh, and then, you know, sort of slowly it kind of morphed from being people joking to people not joking.
Yeah.
One difference is that Anonymous is a set of people who have some proficiency with technology as hackers. And it wasn't clear that that was the case with QAnon.
They appeared
to be playing a role-playing game, you know, that turned into something more. Oh, go ahead, Pat.
No, that's okay. I sit corrected. I remember now that QAnon did come out of 4chan, Wendy's right.
So. It was really interesting reading his book about that, actually, because it came out around the same time as Naomi Klein's book on the doppelganger. And
what's the name of this book?
James Ball. I'll have to look it up and email it to you.
Okay, thanks.
I can email you my review of it. The interesting thing was that because Ball spent his teenage years hanging around 4chan, he kind of described the same thing that Klein did, but he was describing it from the inside out, whereas Klein came to it as a novice and sort of studied it from the outside in, trying to figure out why people kept confusing her with Naomi Wolf.
I've been reading Doppelganger.
It's really good.
It is. It's very good. And
that's the one. That's the one.
Okay. Thank you. I have to say that I always liked her, and I did get her confused with the other one. And I was, you know, I thought, oh, damn, we lost another one, you know.
Yeah.
How could she go insane like this? And when I saw the book and I found out what was happening, I really felt stupid.
I thought actually that, the thing that was interesting was her theory about what happened to Naomi Wolf. I remember reading a lot on Twitter the day that Naomi Wolf was, you know, released her new book, went on the BBC, and was absolutely taken apart by a historian who pointed out that she had all her facts backwards. And she had utterly misinterpreted some court records. She'd misread them, misinterpreted them, and come up with the exact wrong end of the stick. And Klein kind of traces her abrupt change to that, you know, now she was kind of ostracized by all the people, you know, all the sort of liberals and stuff that she was used to. And she was welcomed with open arms by the sort of extreme right wing, because, you know, anytime you can own a liberal, that's a great thing, you know? And so she became sort of a pet, you know?
Ew.
Yeah.
Well, not a pet. I
should say that you weren't the only one, Pat. I was confused about the Naomis too, and I was actually relieved that that book Doppelganger appeared, because it helped me sort things out.
Wendy mentioned the extreme right wing, and I was looking at something you posted on He Who Will Not Name's a social media outlet. It said, woke up this morning, I'm having a harder time dealing with Trump as president than I ever did with dealing with cancer. Can you expound on that? Because that's an interesting comparison.
You know, all I can say is if I were given a choice, I could live healthy, but Trump would be president, or we could have a proper government, only I'd have cancer. I would choose door number two. I'd choose to have cancer, because I've never, ever been so embarrassed and ashamed of being, you know, American. And I sometimes I want to run around and tell people I voted as hard as I could, you know, or I don't know what to do, because if I did, I'd be doing it right now. And I think it's because, you know, I have cancer. Well, I just have cancer, and that doesn't affect very many people, but I have a very hard time imagining, you know, what's going to happen to people in the next few years. And it's already happening. You know, we're seeing, and unfortunately, a lot of the people who voted for Donald Trump have suddenly discovered that they were the fat that Donald Trump wanted to cut from the government. I guess they thought they were going to get a pass. When Trump said explicitly that he was going to fire everyone in civil service and hire people who were just loyal to him. So I guess the people who were just loyal to him, who are already working there, thought that they were going to, you know, that Trump would be careful to exempt them from getting fired. And now they're, you know, it's like there are people who are 66 years old who are not going to be able to get another job, you know, and other people who've lost their pensions, you know, lost their income. And it's never a good time to lose your income, but especially now when everything, all kinds of aid is being, you know, is being cut with a chainsaw from the government budget.
There was that line, wasn't there, that Democrats take Trump literally but not seriously, and Republicans take Trump seriously but not literally. And so, you know, what's happening is the Republicans are discovering that they should have taken him literally as well, yeah, as seriously.
Yeah, and I actually feel terrible for those people. You know, I think I feel really bad for them, because when your side wins, you know, you're supposed to enjoy the victory, and now they're being treated like the enemy.
Well, Trump doesn't like anybody.
Well, that's because nobody is real except him.
I just briefly put up something about the leopards. Ate my face party, leopards eating people's faces party.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And talking about voters who voted for cruel and unjust policies, and then they're surprised when those policies apply to them.
Yep. Yeah.
I guess there's not a lot of politics in cyberpunk exactly. I mean, there's not like movements and that sort of thing, I guess. I can't think of having read any cyberpunk where there was actually a discussion about like political events. There was a political implication, but there wasn't a direct.
See, and I think that's why cyberpunk has a wide readership among both liberals and conservatives. You know, I know that I have actually quite a wide conservative readership. And it's because we agree on what makes a good story. And, of course, you know, it's like people who read science fiction are intelligent. So they don't tend to. You know, it's funny. There are people who believe that there are space lasers and weather control machines, but they don't believe in vaccines. that's something else that cyberpunk got wrong. And we thought that, you know, it's like the wide dissemination of information would mean that everybody would know things. We didn't anticipate that people would simply look at the truth and deny it, even as it was happening in front of their faces. Which I guess the ate off. So,
well, we're learning a lot about the human mind, I guess, and about memory, and about— people really don't have very good, solid, accurate memories for the most part. I see this in myself every day, and in others too. And I realized that in 4 years of a Joe Biden presidency, people who had been very concerned about Trump and how he operated just forgot. They forgot. It's like it slipped
it's
their
like
mind.
Women, it's like women who gave birth forgetting enough of what it was like to get pregnant a second time.
Well, you know, it's not so much that. It's where it gets you is when the first kid is at a certain age, and it's so adorable that that overrules everything.
And then one day you wake up and you have two surly teenagers. Yeah.
So, well,
I've been seeing a lot of mainstream, well, television fiction, for instance, with a cyberpunk influence. Most recently, a Netflix series called Zero Day.
I just watched that.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a little bit of a cyberpunk vibe to that. The way that the technology played into the story, especially.
Yeah, and the
I'm trying to think about the other one. Paradise. There's another one called Paradise, which. Yeah, but that's just it. It's kind of mainstream now. We don't really think of it as anything but, you know, mainstream fiction.
That kind of leads to something I was curious about, which is, you know, when I started reading science fiction, there was still a lot of space travel and a lot of exploration of, you know, scientific principles. What would happen if this, you know, Asimov did a lot of that. What would happen if a world had six suns, or, you know, whatever, and then working out the science of it. And then, you know, at some point it's shifted to being about, you know, cyberpunk, you know, and computers and all of that. What's the next big paradigm? Because, you know, it seems like we're due, kind of.
Well, I'm not sure. There's a lot I can't see because I'm very troubled by the truth deniers. You know, you can lay something out for them and show them, no, Joe Biden didn't start any wars, and, you know, and here are the figures on his employment rose and all of the good things that he did. And people will say, well, that's a lie. They're all lies. And, you know, and that's it. They will dismiss whatever evidence you give them as, you know, as being made up. And this is what scares me more so much, you know, because this is how Trump managed to, you know, get in. He simply kept telling lies, and people went for it. And I'm wondering, you know, it's like, will the next great paradigm be something that we've already had, we have to go through again, like having to campaign to vaccinate kids against polio and their MMR shots and all of those things. You know, we kind of got rewound without you know, the time rewinding. We're having, you know, the future in 1954 or something.
Yeah,
Scoop, go ahead.
I recently revisited an early TV cyberpunk themed series, Max Headroom, which was, you know, kind of silly.
I have it on DVD.
Yeah, I got the entire collection, and I was amazed at how current it seems in listening to these things from the 1980s about evil TV networks that lied to everyone and manipulated politics and a lot of stuff, you know, security related things, you know, people being spied upon and having their identities stolen. That was really was science fiction in the 80s. But looking at it now, it's like they were way ahead of their time.
Well, part of it is because this time is so much like the spirit of the 80s. Greed is good. You're winning if you know, the one with the most toys wins, whether you're alive or dead. Screw your neighbor. As long as you've got enough, you're okay. Don't help other people. And anyone who's taking charity is a welfare cheat. And oh my God, don't let those foreigners in.
You know, I think this is one area where it makes an enormous difference having a nationalized healthcare system, because you know, governments that have to consider the cost of vaccines and the cost versus the cost of treating the people who get sick because they haven't been vaccinated have a powerful motive to actually get vaccines into people's arms.
Yeah.
And, you know, the profit motive so dominates American healthcare that all the incentives are twisted. Great example. I was talking on a Zoom call on Monday with a bunch of expatriate Americans, and I was talking about, you know, cataract surgery, and one of them said, well, you know, you got to be careful because my doctor kept pushing this one kind of lens and it turned out he was getting kickbacks from the manufacturer. And you sort of had to say to him, yeah, it doesn't work like that here, because the industry just buys in bulk and they're a very large purchaser and they can actually dictate things. It doesn't come down to the individual doctor necessarily, you know. And they have no idea. Because, you know, it's been dismissed as socialized medicine for so long that just like none of them can see anything good about it.
Yeah, I know. And this is one thing that I really don't understand. It's like if you laid it out and explained it to someone in the U.S., how they would think that socialized medicine, the way we have it, is a bad thing. You know, I don't understand why people think that it's not better to not be bankrupted. You know, it's like I had emergency gallbladder surgery in the United States. It was one of the last things that I ever had in the U.S. It was emergency gallbladder surgery on a weekend with no health insurance. And the bill was in six figures. And I only stayed overnight, like two nights.
The dumbest thing a smart person ever said to me was that he thought that nationalized healthcare was a bad thing, like the way they do it in the UK, where it's free at the point of use. He said, it's a bad thing because I want people to have skin in the game. It's like, you think
they do have skin in the game.
The system in order to take insulin? You think people are going to like smoke more because cancer treatment is free? What is this?
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's a weird thing. It just creates, I mean, we hear a lot about efficiency here lately, especially with our Department of Government efficiency. But think about the inefficiency of a healthcare system that operates the way this one does. Specifically, the fact that so many people can't afford to pay for health care, so they all have to flock to the emergency room. And the emergency rooms are stacked up with people who are not necessarily having emergencies, but it's really the only way they're guaranteed that they can get health care.
Yep.
Or what about the it must be billions of hours over time that are spent just wrangling with insurance companies. I mean, that's time nobody ever gets back. It's not productive. It doesn't do anything for anybody.
No.
I don't have that anymore. It's a good thing that we have Medicare. I see that it might disappear soon, but Medicare has been kind of a godsend for us. I mean, whatever we need done, we get done, and we don't have to worry about the payment. You know, it gets paid for. I suppose that's a lot like socialized medicine in England.
It is. You know, it's like, and so it should be. You know, people who need treatment should get treatment, you know, and there are a lot of ways to pay for that. You know, it's the England did it very well for a long time. The problem is in England is like, as in America, billionaires and millionaires aren't paying their fair share of taxes. You know, they're dodging it here the way they're dodging it there.
Well, it's not, they're trying to take that off the table as an option. And, you know, the arguments here are all about how can we cut to the point where we can sustain the tax cuts for billionaires. They have no interest in paying their, some do. I mean, there's some billionaires who would happily pay their fair share, but that's not the attitude at the moment within our government, with our administration. The attitude is that we need to find some way to sustain tax cuts, and we really can't do it unless we make cuts to spending. And really the only spending cuts that will effectively work in order to reduce the deficit that was created by the tax cuts and will get worse and worse are cuts to programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and defense too. Yes. All things that many agree that we absolutely need and that we shouldn't abandon. And I can just imagine the furor that we're going to see if Social Security is cut in any substantial or significant way in this country, because so many people depend on it, including me.
Yeah, there are many, many people who depend on it across the entire spectrum of politics. And I don't think that anything is going to get done until something happens to really, really affect the people who supported Trump, who put him in office. Now, maybe maybe part of that will be the mass firings, you know, of the civil servants, and maybe some of that will be cuts in Medicare and Medicaid of people who, you know, have depended on that for, you know, for their for health. And but something real has to happen, something that really affects people. But maybe it's, you know, $14 for a dozen eggs. I don't know.
But isn't one of the problems, I mean, as I understand it, if you look at Trump's numbers, they didn't change that much from over the three elections that he ran. What really changed in 2024 was a lot of Democrats didn't come out and vote.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a much harder thing to fix.
Yeah. Yeah, there isn't much you can do if people don't show up.
Well, there's an argument. There are different arguments about why they didn't vote. There were some who didn't vote because they were upset about the position on Palestine, Palestinians. But there were also, I think, people who didn't vote because they were just complacent. They said, well, you know, Kamala Harris is going to win. She doesn't need my vote. She did. I mean, she needed everybody's vote.
Yeah.
And
there were a bunch of people who didn't like Kamala Harris.
Yeah. That's how well, we ended up with Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. Democrats stayed home.
Yeah.
You know, one of Trump's big things is, well, not Trump, but his sidekick, the co-president, Musk. He has shut down the CFPB, which Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He's going to do away with that. And that's the bureau that just said, or was just working on finalizing, removing medical bills from credit reports. And that's a really important thing. A lot of people couldn't get a job or get insurance or get anything because their credit report was just filled with, you know, medical debt.
Yeah.
And having a wife who went through breast cancer twice and then having to have a leg amputated, we ran up about a $3 million bill that we would have had to pay if we didn't have Medicare.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what someone hit with that? You would have to just, I guess, change your name or move out of the country if you had that kind of debt on top of you.
Well, you would declare bankruptcy. That's
yeah, I did bankruptcy court.
And I think a very high percentage of bankruptcies in the U.S. are due to medical bills, and most of them are people who have health insurance.
Yeah, because health insurance isn't enough.
You know, Roger Ebert, before he died in the years after he had cancer, he kept a very voluminous blog in which he posted millions of words. And I remember him writing about health insurance and saying that he had two health insurance plans. One had already been maxed out by the surgeries he'd had, and the other one would be maxed out if he had one more surgery. Now, by any reasonable standard, Ebert was a highly successful American.
Mm-hmm.
And if health insurance wasn't going to work for him, it wasn't going to work for anybody. And that's the thing, is life is a crapshoot. You have absolutely no idea when a catastrophic medical illness might hit you. It's not something you can, yeah, I mean, sure, you can try to weight the odds by living a certain way and eating well and getting enough sleep and all the things they tell you to do. But you can't actually stop catastrophic medical things from happening to you.
No, you can't. And
it's that fundamental unfairness.
Well, this has me thinking about cyberpunk. How much did those implants cost?
Oh, God. that's a good question. I remember I had brain implants in centers. And, of course, the company that developed them paid to have them put in, but I never did think much about that. You know, it's like in my future, there people just weren't worrying about health insurance or their health.
I actually, well, I've run across there's a television series called Cyberpunk on Netflix. It's anime, and it's quite a bit about people having implants, certain kinds of implants.
Yeah.
And they are very much focused on the cost of those implants. So reality has caught up with cyberpunk, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
Did you ever think in your novels, did you ever sort of think about a large company having the kind of control over a brain implant or some other physical implant such that, you know, if the company went bust or just felt like turning it off, they could?
You know, that I never did consider that as part of the plot. And it would be, that would be a good continuation for something along the lines of, you know, a new cyberpunk story.
There was a conference. Andrea Matushin has done a bunch of work on the Internet of Bodies, as she calls it. And there was, I think it was one of the privacy conferences, she was doing a session on a paper in progress. And the line that came up repeatedly was, a pancreas has never called the internet, called home before.
You know, so far.
The notion of the pancreas being on the internet, you know, I mean, that definitely seems to me cyberpunkish.
Well, that's the Internet of Things for you.
Yes.
I wrote,
well, if you get a pacemaker, the pacemaker phones home.
Yeah. I have a friend who has an insulin pump, and she had one of the first insulin pumps that could upload directly to, you know, to her doctor via the internet.
I read a book, actually, written by somebody who had a fancy pacemaker and was trying to understand, like, all the technology behind it and the companies behind it and so forth. You know, and then we were started out talking about privacy, and one of the things is, you know, you're on the operating table and the doctor says, I want to put this pacemaker in. You're not in a position to say, can I please read the privacy policy?
Yeah.
Well, that's really true. Important. You know, we had a recent discussion with some participatory medicine guys, one of whom is Hugo Campos. And Hugo Campos is a kind of cyberpunk guy. He got a pacemaker and was very concerned about the data that was being gathered and stored on his pacemaker. And he ultimately started acquiring black market pacemakers. When somebody has died and they're going to be, like, incinerated, they have to remove the pacemaker first, yeah, or it'll explode. So they have these pacemakers laying around. And there's kind of a black market where you can actually buy those things. And he bought a few of those and was hacking into them to try to find out just what data they were storing, because he could not get access to his data. If you have a pacemaker, you really can't get access to the data yourself. It will send data to, you know, to the physicians, but it's never shared with you. And there is a trend to have medical data shared more and more. But it hadn't really caught up with that quite yet.
I just saw a cheesy crime show where a person in witness protection had a pacemaker, and that's how the bad guys tracked him down. Was he didn't have a cell phone or any kind of communication, but his pacemaker led the bad guys to him.
Yeah, I think I either saw that or you know, saw part of it or something. And it seems to me that it's one of those magic hacker stories where hackers can get into absolutely anything. You know, that's sort of the B grade cyberpunk. When they need something to be hackable, they fix it so that anyone can get into it at any time. You know, if you just know the right formula, it's like when someone's picking a lock on television, you'd think that all you have to do is stick a crooked wire into a lock, jiggle it around, and then a door will open for you. You know,
I just read about a current thing that's happened in the city of Plano, Texas, and they had installed wireless water meters so that they didn't have to go around with a person reading the water meters to see how much to bill the people for. And they did a firmware upgrade and it bricked the entire system, and it's going to take years to replace. So there's a little technology horror story for you.
Oh, we've got smart meters for electricity here.
Yeah, I don't have one, actually. I keep resisting having it put in after reading Ross Anderson's work on it.
Mm-hmm.
Ross pointed out that, you know, they have this, what the utility companies wanted was the ability to turn off your electric meter remotely so that if somebody was just not paying for months on end, they could actually just cut them off. And Ross had this whole idea. He was a security engineer at Cambridge, and he had this whole sort of idea that, you know, if they weren't careful, hackers would hack into the grid and just shut it down.
Yeah.
And then it would, you know, and then it would take weeks to restore. And you could really paralyze modern civilization that way.
Yeah. Well, that's one reason why my husband refuses to get one.
Yeah, I spent a little too much time with Ross.
Well, I hate to say it, but we have reached the end of our hour.
Oh, already?
That was fun.
This has been a great conversation.
Yes.
So much fun. We hope you'll come back and join us again soon.
I will. I will. And this time I will try to be camera ready. But
right.
I always have such a great time talking to you guys.
Yeah, this is really fun. Best part of our day. Well, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, everyone. I'm going to go torment my Alexa now.
Okay, and I am going to turn us off. So.
Okay.
Thanks, Pat.
Thanks, all.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Pat.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.